Well, good afternoon, and welcome to our final argument of the term. So this is going to be an interesting argument from the briefs. But before we begin, my notes tell me we have some students here from Lakeland Union High School. If that's correct, would they and their advisor please stand? Oh, my, very good. Thank you. Please be seated. Did you all have time to come and hear Justice Ziegler over the lunch hour? Very good, very good. The students are here with a Court with Class program that we operate in coordination with the State Bar, so they've learned a little bit about the case that you're going to be arguing to us in a few minutes. I'd like to introduce the rest of the court. On my far right, Justice Rebecca Bradley. Next to her, of course, Justice Ziegler, you all know. Next to me, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Next to her, Justice Michael Gableman. And on the far end, Justice Daniel Kelly. So, with those brief introductions, I will call our last case for the day, State versus Asforth. Am I saying it correctly?
Asforth.
Okay, very good. Are you ready to proceed? Please do.
My name is Andrew Hinkle from the State Public Defender Appellate Division, and may it please the court. Clearly, the Supreme Court of the United States has left a lot of questions open in the area of vehicle impoundments that are conducted for community caretaker reasons. There are two cases that both the state and I rely on in the briefing extensively, Opperman and Bertine. Neither one of them, they both sort of set out general categories, this general category of possible seizure and then the attendant search that follows the seizure, without supplying much in the way of analysis or doctrine as to how to know when a particular seizure is valid. That's been left to the lower courts. And as I think the briefing from both sides shows, courts have come down all over the place on this. There are a lot of different doctrinal disputes as to whether, for example, standard criteria are required, whether they're merely an aid to determining whether a particular seizure is valid.
Counsel, you, in your introduction, which I've now timed at 47 seconds so I can ask a question. I'm teasing. I don't know. You seem to be focusing on seizure, but twice you threw in the word search. What are the, is a valid inventory search an issue presented in this case?
Not directly, only insofar as the search would be invalid if the seizure of the vehicle was invalid. The search is itself a fruit of the impoundment of the car.
But case law indicates that there's a separate analysis, that for the impoundment you have a seizure subject to Fourth Amendment scrutiny, and for an inventory you have a search subject to Fourth Amendment scrutiny. And so both your comments at the get-go, so to speak, that you just made, and also the statement of your issues in your brief seem to focus on the impoundment and on the seizure. But like your introductory statement, your first page of issues presented, I think twice mentions the word search. So I just want to know what we're here about. You have in your second issue, the search is not a pretext. I mean, is that part of your argument here, distinct from the seizure, the impoundment versus the inventory search?
No, our challenge is only to the impoundment or seizure, whatever term you'd like to use. If the impoundment was valid, then we don't have an objection. We haven't made an argument that the seizure was independently unconstitutional.
Why, was it done according to the policies or standards of the department?
That's correct.
The search.
Okay.
So there are two different standards for seizure and search.
That's correct.
For a search, the cases I think, hold that you've got to have a police policy, a law enforcement office, law enforcement department policy, and it has to be complied with. Otherwise, the search becomes a way of just getting stuff.
That's
right?
Correct. That's okay. Most directly, that's Florida v. Wells.
All right. So you're not attacking the search because the search would be okay under the law. That's your principle. Is that the point?
That's correct.
All right. So what you're going to do is say the seizure is bad. That is the empowerment.
That's correct.
The way you use empowerment, and I think the Seventh Circuit does this, they use it to be seizure, right?
Correct.
It's, all right.
The terms pop up more or less interchangeably in the cases.
Okay. So what's the issue in this case relating to seizure?
Well, there are two overarching issues. The first is that both the state and Mr. Asbeth are in agreement that to be valid, a vehicle impoundment must be a valid community caretaker function, at least as it comes to this in this situation.
Well, this is a Fourth Amendment case, right?
That's correct.
So to seize property, right, under the Fourth Amendment, unless you have a warrant, and there's no warrant in this case, is there?
No, there's not.
Therefore, you've got to have some other reason.
Correct.
And the only other reason is that they took it as a caretaker function.
Correct.
All right.
And community caretaker, the phrase community caretaker is itself relied upon in Opperman, one of the Supreme Court of the United States cases
That's the South Dakota v. Opperman.
Correct.
All right.
And specifically what that case says is that the authority of the police to seize and remove from the streets vehicles that are impeding traffic or threatening public safety and convenience may not be questioned or is beyond question or something along those lines. And it's important to look at that particular phrasing. And I think here it's useful to look at the analogy of another type of search that occurs without a warrant, which is searches of a vehicle that follow the arrest of the driver automatically. Now, in 1981, the Supreme Court of the United States released New York versus Belton, or Belton versus New York, and they upheld such a search. They said that when Mr. Belton was arrested, the police had the authority to search any part of the passenger compartment of his car, including his glove compartment, et cetera, simply because, well, that's what they said. What the lower courts that then developed the law almost uniformly said was that what that meant was that any time the driver of a vehicle was arrested, police had essentially carte blanche to search the entire vehicle.
Now, that's not the law anymore, is it?
That's not the law anymore.
Right.
And the reason for that is when Belton was decided, they said, well, the reasons justifying this rule are, first, that a suspect who's in a car could reach for a weapon, thereby putting the policeman or woman in danger, or the suspect in the car could destroy evidence, thereby hindering criminal investigation. Now, the lower courts, looking at that case, essentially said, you can always search the car, regardless of whether the suspect is even in the car anymore. So there were many, many cases upholding searches of vehicles where the suspect, the driver, was already in the back seat of a squad car, handcuffed, and therefore had no realistic way to access any weapon or any evidence that might be in the car.
It became a per se search.
Correct. Until 2009, when the Supreme Court decided Gant, and that's Arizona versus Gant. And
in that case, there's an increase in impoundment activity since we no longer have under Gant search incident to arrest?
Well, that's an interesting question. It does. The new rule of Gant does certainly give police a greater incentive, if you will, to impound vehicles for what are purported to be community caretaker reasons. Because it did used to be automatic that arresting someone would give them more or less carte blanche to search the car. Gant took that away, but I can't answer your question statistically or anything like that.
Why are you citing Gant?
Well, because
this is not a search of the car. We've already established you're objecting to the seizure of the car.
Well, because what Gant said was, listen, lower courts, you've gotten this all wrong. We had two specific reasons that justified the search in Belton. And if those reasons are not present, then the search is not valid. And in fact, in most cases involving an arrest, officers don't search the car with the person sitting in the car. Typically, the person is arrested and is in the backseat of the squad car. So most of the time, Gantt said, these searches are not valid. And I think that's a similar thing to what's happened here. Many courts, and certainly it's the state's position, are taking the position that the fact that Mr. Asbeth was arrested and that, you know, he could no longer drive his car because he was in police custody gave them the authority to impound the car. And, of course, I'm going to say it again, concomitantly search the car, you know, from head to toe, even though, again, we're not challenging the search on its own. The ability to search flowed directly from that impoundment. And I think, so it's important for this court to take a look back at that language that's in Opperman about the reasons that we allow the police to impound vehicles, and that is that they may threaten public safety, impede traffic, or threaten public safety and convenience. So, and we have to ask in this case, is that what Mr. Esba's car was doing when it was parked on this private property of a storage facility?
Well, one of my questions is, community caretaker is not limited to this impoundment issue.
No, there are all sorts of actions.
Okay. So what we have is the community caretaker, which comes up in a number of different cases, applies here. And so what is viewed as community caretaker, like safety of individuals, damage to property, et cetera, everything will come in here under community caretaker. I mean, you've limited it, and I don't think you intend to, just impede traffic and safety issues under Opperman.
I guess I wouldn't dispute that there might be other reasons that would justify a community caretaker impoundment. But
all right. Now, here, where was the car? Where was the car when it was impounded?
It was parked in front of it's a storage shed on a facility that has several such sheds. I'm not sure how many.
The storage facility.
With, you know, the big garage doors that open and you can store your stuff in there. And it was parked. There's a picture which is in the appendix of my brief. Mm-hmm. Obviously, looking at the picture, it's impossible to say just how close it was to Mr. Asbeth's locker. Although there was testimony from one of the police officers on the scene that the lane in which it was parked was, I think he said, two to three car widths.
Yeah.
Meaning that Mr. Asbeth's vehicle was not making it impossible to travel that lane.
Was his locker the one that's open in the picture? There's one that's got the front door pulled up and out of the way. Was that
his? I don't know that there's direct testimony to that, but I think it's a fairly safe assumption because he was there.
Well,
at his locker. So
okay. Is it your
position? No one else around.
According to the record, could other people approach their lockers even if the car was left exactly where it was?
There was testimony from officers that it might be difficult to pull your vehicle directly up to the locker directly next to Mr. Asbus. Not that it couldn't be accessed.
Make it a little more difficult to get access.
Maybe slightly more difficult.
What was the safety issue?
I don't think there was a safety issue. I think if you look, first of all, what we're talking about is a parked car. We don't typically recoil in horror from parked cars. We see them every day. There are thousands of them in this city. Situations in which public safety is threatened by parked cars are those like that was present in Bertine, where the driver was arrested for operating while intoxicated and his vehicle is actually parked in a lane of traffic on a highway. Clearly, if your car is parked in a place where you expect vehicles to be going at a high rate of speed, that presents a danger. Here, it's hard to imagine a situation in which it was a threat to other traffic. The state suggests that perhaps a fire could have broken out of the storage facility, or there could have been some other unspecified emergency that would require total access to the storage sheds there by emergency responders. I think if that's good enough, then any parked car anywhere presents a threat to public safety. In answer to your question, I don't believe it was any serious threat to public safety.
There seems to be an issue here about who was the owner of this car.
That's correct. Mr. Asbeth was the owner, first of all.
Well, I gather that, but if you looked at the registration of the car, who would be the owner?
It appeared it was registered to someone else, someone who lived here in Madison, rather than to Mr. Asbeth.
What difference does all that make?
Well, I guess I would say the fact that a person is in possession of a vehicle that is registered to someone else is not an unusual occurrence and not something that we would ordinarily regard as suspicious. And it's not something that we would regard as creating an exigency with respect to we have to figure out what to do with this vehicle right now. The simplest thing to do would have been simply to ask Mr. Asbeth how he came to be in possession of the car. I think in general the law in various Fourth Amendment cases has not suggested that someone doesn't have a right to privacy in their vehicle just because it happens to belong or be registered to someone else. In this case, Mr. Asbeth had in fact exchanged some number of hundreds of dollars with the owner, and he purchased the car and I guess just hadn't gotten around to transferring the registry.
There's something else going on in this case, and that is that he is a suspect in a bank robbery. So you've got both of this community caretaker in juxtaposition with he's a suspect in a bank robbery case, and a probation violation also comes into play. Is it your position that we have in this case presented standardized criteria for impounding, sufficient standardized criteria for impounding regardless of which of the two jurisdictions you want to focus on, Beaver Dam or Dodge County, or is it your position that both would be insufficient?
It's our position that both are insufficient. It's our position that it's the Beaver Dam policy that governs, but regardless of which policy governs, it's our position that they're insufficient under the law.
But there is at least some case law that indicates that if you have a sufficient, whatever that might mean, a standardized policy, that you probably or you may be okay for Fourth Amendment purposes, even if it doesn't meet the two goals of Opperman. Do you think that's a correct statement of the law?
I agree that there are cases that can be read to suggest that. I do not agree that it's a correct statement of the law. For example, clearly, and there's, you know, I can't remember which court stated this, one of the higher courts, police by creating policies cannot constitutionalize searches that would otherwise be unconstitutional. So, for example, if the policy said we impound all blue cars or all cars manufactured after the year 2000, clearly there's no basis to do so under the Constitution, and that would be a constitutional violation.
In part because of the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment, reasonableness.
That's right. And to respond to something that you said at the beginning of your question, it's true that he was a suspect in a bank robbery, and we're ultimately here on an appeal of his conviction in that bank robbery. And I just want to stress that the fact that he was suspected of robbing this bank is completely irrelevant to the question of whether his vehicle was subject to impoundment for community caretaker reasons.
Well, why is it completely irrelevant? You have in your statement of issues the word pretext, if I recall correctly. And part of, I thought, your argument was that, look, this impoundment really wasn't for public safety or traffic control, as Opperman indicates. It was a pretext. They wanted to get stuff on him for the bank robbery.
You caught me. I've spoken a little too broadly. What I meant to say was that it's irrelevant to the question of whether there was sufficient community caretaker basis for the impoundment. And I think it absolutely is relevant when it comes to the discussion of pretext. And the reason that it's irrelevant is simply that the justifications that the Supreme Court has permitted have not been, well, because he's a scary guy, we get to impound his car. If that were a justification, if that did weigh in the analysis, then it begins to look a lot like what we're doing is an end run around Gantt and simply conducting searches for which we lack the requisite probable cause.
Counsel, what if what if this was pretextual? And not just pretextual, but so pretextual that what actually motivated the impoundment was the police saying, look, we came out here to apprehend a bank robber. And here he is in the back of his car in front of a storage shed. Wonder what he might be doing in the back of his car in front of a storage shed. Maybe what he's doing is secreting the fruits and instrumentalities of crime. And why this gives us probable cause to search. And there are exigent circumstances here because if we just trundle Mr. Asboth off and leave his car here, maybe a compatriot will come along and clean it out. And that's the reason for doing the impoundment.
I'm sorry, I don't understand. Is the question whether that would be lawful?
Correct.
No, I don't think it would. First of all, as I'm sure Your Honor is aware, the state has never attempted to defend the search on the basis of...
That is true. And I'll ask them
there being
about
probable
that.
Cause. Nevertheless, I don't agree that there would be probable cause on that basis. The bank robbery occurred around a month before Mr. Asboth was spotted at this storage facility. There's simply not enough reason to suspect that the items that, especially given that he took, I think it was, allegedly took $1,300 or something like that is what he got away with from the bank. It's hard to imagine that a month later he was storing that cash in a storage facility.
Or the instrumentality of crime. Right?
Pardon?
Or the instrumentality of crime.
It would certainly
turns out he did store that in the car.
It would certainly be possible that he would do so, and of course it was in fact, he didn't have it in the facility, but he had it in the car. The fact that they did in fact find it in the car, I still would maintain doesn't rise to the level of there having been probable cause that it would be there at that time.
So what is the effect of pretextual? The general rule in search and seizure cases is pretext is okay. Cops can really think that he's a drug dealer and they stop him from faulty lights, right?
Correct.
All right. That's accepted and is generally okay. Is pretext okay in the caretaker issue?
Well, this court has held that pretext was not an issue in general with respect to community caretaker actions. My position is that the analysis is different when we're talking specifically about these administrative impoundments and searches.
Okay, well, what is your analysis on pretext?
Well, in United States versus Wren, the Supreme Court said that, of course, the defendant in Wren had been arguing that, of course, that the search was pretextual, that he was pulled over essentially because they were suspecting him of drug activity, but really they got him on a taillight or something like that. And the court said, you know, as you said, that's fine. They had probable cause. They saw that traffic violation.
Right.
But they also said, with respect to all these other sorts of searches, we've said that essentially purpose matters. That is, searches that are purportedly carried out on the basis of some purpose other than the detection of crime actually have to be carried out on those purposes. I think the policy reasons for that are fairly straightforward. By definition, we're dealing with a situation in which the police lack sufficient suspicion to take whatever action it is they're taking. And if these are pretextual actions, if these are pretextual acts, what we have is essentially these warrantless seizures and warrantless searches. And as I said earlier, it's a convenient and, I think, tempting route to get around what are the bedrock sort of rules of the Fourth Amendment, that we don't conduct searches without probable cause. We don't conduct seizures without probable cause.
Well, you present the issue as, does the Constitution require the state to show that a community caretaker impoundment and search is not a pretext concealing criminal investigatory motives? Was the impoundment here a valid, non-pretextual community caretaker action when the vehicle was parked at a private storage facility and proposed neither a threat to public safety nor a traffic hazard? I'm assuming that your answer is that the Constitution does require the state to show that the impoundment is not a pretext.
That's correct.
All right. Now, suppose they have mixed motives. One, it's in the way, it's in a fire lane, it's not, but there are fire lanes in these, in many of these storage units. So, they want to impound it because it's a threat. But not a bad idea because might just have something that's of use in the robbery, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of mixed motive. But the dominant one, and I think that we have a case that indicates it's okay even in a caretaker, community caretaker function, that you not only are performing the caretaker function, but you have in the back of your head or front of your head that you might also find a crime, right?
There is that rule in general.
Okay. So why isn't it a mixed motive here?
Well, I mean, first of all, I don't think there has been a finding by the circuit court as to the motive of the police as far as the impoundment goes. The court did say with respect to the subsequent inventory that it was not conducted for the sole purpose of criminal investigation, mm-hmm. but there was no factual finding with respect to the motives for the impoundment. With respect to mixed motivations, I mean, it's hard to, we all know that people can hold more than two reasons in their head at the same time, and I would say that the test should be whether the police were primarily motivated by an intent to
And what carry case out crime. Do you rely on?
I don't have a case for that.
Well, the cases that indicate that you have to, there shouldn't be pretext in an impoundment?
Well, again, the Opperman and Bertine both say that these particular, well, in one it was, I believe actually in both it was the case of inventories, but that they weren't carried out in bad faith or for the sole purpose of investigation.
So if sole purpose is the test, then the mixed motive saves the impoundment.
No, I'm sorry. I need to backtrack a little bit. Those were with respect to the
search.
Inventories.
Well, and, that's and, search. And we're not dealing with the search part, right?
Well, those statements were about the search part. So what, I guess what I'm saying is
the statements were about the search.
Pardon?
Were the statements about the search?
Correct.
Okay. And
correct.
We're only arguing about the seizure.
Right. And it's the seizure that has to comply with the community caretaker rules. Well, essentially, and I think, and I'll note that my red light is on, essentially, it only addresses, the community caretaker requirements only need to be complied with respect to the impoundment. It's more or less automatic that the searches occur if the impoundment happens. And so it makes sense to say, well, in that case, the only the most extreme, egregious violations or mixed motives or no motives in favor of community caretaker reasons would save the search.
Okay. So thank you very much.
So the motive in the community caretaker cases would be the same here. That is, in the back of your head, you can have a search. You can have a criminal.
I'm sorry.
In the community caretaker cases, you can have as your primary purpose community caretaking, but the law enforcement officer can have in his head also, or in her head also, that there might be a crime afoot and they might find evidence.
That is the rule in community caretaker cases,
and
generally.
Is that the rule you want applied here?
No.
You want it further, a different rule.
I do. I think that if the primary purpose of law enforcement, or the primary purpose is law enforcement, then it becomes a pretextual search or impoundment.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Chief Deputy Solicitor General Ryan Walsh on behalf of the State of Wisconsin. The decision to seize Aspeth's car in this case was not only merely reasonable, it was good police work. Start with the fact that the car was left in front of at least three storage units in the middle of a facility that belonged to someone else. It was also parked in roughly the middle of the lane between two rows of storage garages, and the circuit court found, as a matter of historical fact, that it obstructed travel throughout the facility.
Give me the findings of the circuit court. My recollection, but help me with this, is that the circuit court indicated that it obstructed the entryway to at least one cubicle or whatever word, storage room. Is that what they found? Is that what the circuit court, Judge Stork, found?
I believe the circuit court said at least two, and that it obstructed travel throughout the facility. But I would reference the court to the picture, which shows the car parked in front of at least three, in the sense that if you were to want to back a U-Haul trailer up to your storage unit because it was move-out day, you wouldn't be able to. The car would be in your way, and one suspects the owner of the facility would not be happy with that, which gets back to the factors of why this is reasonable.
Okay, here's the finding. The vehicle was blocking access to more than one, it says, of the business's storage lockers and impeding travel by other customers through the complex.
That's right. Thank you. What's also in the officer's mind is that when cars are left unattended for a long period of time, they are a potential target for theft and vandalism. That's a particularly important consideration in this case because the officers also know that this car is apparently not Aspeth's in the first place. It could be stolen. Ownership could be in doubt. Courts are uniform on the point that when there is a concern that the car does not belong to the arrestee, they have reason to safeguard the property until the owner can come and retrieve the property. That's the epitome of community caretaking, to take care of someone else's property.
Counsel, let me push back on that just a little bit. It seems to me that people in cities across the state abandon their cars every evening on public streets, as it turns out, as they go home to go to bed. They retrieve them in the morning and they use them, and then at the end of the next day they abandon them again. So how is it that that the police are acting in a community caretaker role by taking the car without knowing how long it would have been there in the first place?
Well, the difference between that common scenario is that the officers here learned that the car was not registered in this person's name, and that it was also parked not on a public street, but in the middle of somebody else's facility.
Okay, so now, given those facts, is it appropriate for the police in their community caretaker role to respond to that situation proportionately? Or does anything that implicates the community caretaker function automatically bring you to impoundment? For example, could they have taken Mr. Asbaugh's keys and moved the car to some place that wasn't obstructing travel?
That's an interesting question. There is no case of which I am aware in which there's any suggestion that the police could themselves make an intrusion into the vehicle to move the car. This court made a decision in Callaway in 1983 involving a car that was parked 20 feet from a place where it would have been legally parked, and there's no suggestion that, well, the reasonable course of action here would have been for the police to move the car 20 feet ahead. So I think there's generally a norm against that sort of thing. The police job is...
Right. And why is that?
Well, I would take the court to Bertin and the cases that precede it. The question under the Fourth Amendment is not what are all the possible alternatives to the course of action that the police chose, viewed in hindsight. That's not the question. That has been the argument here by my friend on the other side. The question is instead, what does the Fourth Amendment require them to consider? We know that the Fourth Amendment does not require police to consider offering the arrestee an affirmative opportunity to make alternative arrangements for the vehicle. We also know from cases across the country that there's no obligation to call the owner of the private lot to make sure that he or she would be okay with taking the car to the impoundment lot.
Let's say that's all true, but then your opposing counsel will say, but pretext. And when the police go from zero to impoundment, when there are a number of different options in between, perhaps he will argue, why shouldn't we find, why shouldn't we use that fact in our analysis of whether there was a pretextual search here?
It's certainly a fact relevant, because under the state's view, and I think under this court's doctrine, all facts bearing on what should be done with this car are relevant. It's not a matter of just looking to a policy, and that's the end-all be-all. But it's interesting to note that in this case, there's been no suggestion that Aspeth, sitting in the car, shouted out to the officers, oh, hey, I know how to arrange for the removal of this car, absent you going from zero to 100 to impoundment. I mean, and courts across the country find that significant. Does the driver provide an opportunity by speaking up himself or herself that would make the decision to impound less reasonable? That's a harder case, but that's not this case.
Counsel, the idea of having alternatives goes to the heart of the reasonableness of the action of the government, doesn't it?
It is highly relevant.
Okay. I look at the Sanders case, the Tenth Circuit case, I think does a nice job of doing a catalog of the different circuits and how they've come down on this issue. And it indicates the following, and says, when discerning, if it's our challenge, they say, is discern if this is reasonable or if we're talking about something that's pretextual. And making that decision is not easy. It says as follows: ascertaining whether an impoundment is justified by a reasonable and legitimate non-pretextual community caretaker rationale is not an easy task. And then they note the following factors, and this gets to the alternatives. It's non-inclusive list. Number one, whether the vehicle is on public or private property. Number two, if on private property, whether the property owner has been consulted. Number three, whether an alternative to impoundment exists, especially another person capable of driving the vehicle. Number four, whether the vehicle is implicated in a crime. And number five, whether the vehicle owner and or driver has consented to the impoundment. So you seem to earlier have been disparaging of alternatives which consist of asking the person that's being arrested if there is something short of impoundment that might work.
I think
you said it's not required by the Fourth Amendment, but that's that goes to the heart of the question. What's reasonable? Because reasonableness is the touchstone.
I agree that this is a somewhat nuanced part of the test. But I think this court has answered how to do the analysis first in State versus Kramer, 2009, a unanimous decision, which is concerned squarely with the question, how do we measure pretext and subjective criminal enforcement motives in the context of community caretaking? The court gave a straightforward answer to that question. If the seizure is justified by an objective basis in community caretaking, then the seizure is justified, full stop. Now, intent factors into the first part of the analysis, but what I said is still true. And this gets to the exchange between Justice Abrahamson and my opposing counsel. I think I would refer the court to Kramer. I think opposing counsel is candid when he says that Kramer covers this situation, and this court would need to create an exception to Kramer for him to prevail.
Well, now, counsel, the threshold question of whether seizure is warranted doesn't fully answer the question before us, though, right? Because you could have the threshold satisfied. Yes, it needs to be seized. It's blocking travel and access to the storage sheds. Now, of what will this seizure consist? Right? That's the next question. Will the seizure consist of moving it out of the lane of travel, or will it consist of towing it to a street parking spot? Will it consist of towing it to the person's home, or will it be impoundment? It seems that that's a significant second piece of the question.
Well, we can do that analysis here. Where do they take the car? It's not his in the first place. might be good to keep the car in an impoundment lot until you can figure out who has title to this vehicle, for one thing. Second question, could they move it within the facility? Well, I put myself in the shoes of the storage facility owner, and my thought is, I don't want this car formerly operated by an arrestee anywhere on my property. I don't want it to be my problem. So would it be reasonable to leave it there? They have to make this decision in the moment, given the circumstances they present, that they're presented with. And as the Supreme Court has emphasized, it is certainly possible to think of alternative arrangements that could have satisfied everybody in hindsight. I mean, with respect, I think that's what we're doing here. And we can come up with some alternatives that might satisfy some of us better than the choice that the officers made. But that's not the question. The Supreme Court has made clear that there are some alternatives that, frankly, police officers are just not required to consider. That was Bertin. He said, I could have called somebody to make arrangements for the disposition of my vehicle. And the Supreme Court said in about three sentences, Fourth Amendment doesn't require that. You're wrong. So I think it's a little bit more of a straightforward inquiry, particularly in a case like this, which there are about five reasons that justify the decision the officers made in this case.
Right. So is it the state's position, then, that there is no need, once the determination has been made that seizure is necessary, there's no need to calibrate the method and consequence of seizure to the circumstances? You can just go straight to the boundaries.
I think, as far as I'm aware, when police seize, they impound. They don't get in a car to move it, generally. This is just the...
I mean, you can imagine, though, the opportunities, right? You know, you're going to have this towed to an impoundment lot. Something short of that, you could have it towed to the corner of the storage facility. You could have it towed to a street parking spot. I mean, there are many things you could do short of impoundment. So what I want to know is whether it's the state's position that when you seize, you can automatically go straight to impoundment.
I think I agree with the gist of the question, what the question is getting at, which is that it is certainly relevant what the alternatives are. That will always be relevant. But in cases like this, and in many such impoundment cases, the alternatives will simply not be feasible, or they won't be alternatives that, under settled doctrine, the police will be required to consider. So I accept the question. I accept the spirit of it. Yes, alternatives are always relevant, but such in this case, for example, we know that they have no alternative of that Asquith gave them no alternative of saying, for example, hey, I know somebody nearby who owns this car. Here's proof of their ownership. Insurance is in their name. They'll be here in 1 minute, and we'll take control of the car. Well, that would change the analysis. I certainly agree with that. And would change how they dispose of the car.
I thought that it was unnecessary, and that if the person said that, the U.S. Supreme Court said that doesn't matter. It seems to me, you keep saying under the circumstances of this case. The circumstances of this case are, according to the state, that this car is on somebody else's private property. And it is an inconvenience to other people on this private property. It interferes with their use of these storage units. And once that decision is made by the state, that the location of this car fits the caretaker, community caretaker function, the police can seize this car and take it wherever it wants to take it. Okay, I'll back off on that. Take it to wherever, to the big police impoundment area in the sky. Okay? That's your position.
That's not. Those factors are a big part of it. But
okay,
it's not just that this car was left on a private facility. It's that we don't know whose car this is. We know that... Oh, I'm sorry.
All right. I'll add that. You don't know whose car it is. It's on a private facility. It's in the lane of traffic, or it's hindering other people using this private facility. The police can take it. They don't have to ask, is it your car, even though it's not registered in your name? They don't have to ask, is there someone who can take this? They don't have to ask the private property owner, not the car owner, can we leave it, can he leave it here indefinitely, somewhere else? They don't have to do anything else. Once they see that it falls within the caretaker function, they can seize it. What other circumstances are there in this case? The police don't have to offer alternatives, and they don't have to ask anyone any questions.
Well, there are a few other circumstances. One is the police are under the impression that Asbeth is wanted on a probation warrant and is also wanted.
They're off the caretaker now.
No. I'll tie it in. It's
okay,
relevant
good.
Because the police understand that the car is not likely to be there for a matter of a few hours. This comes up in cases all the time. What is the offense for which the person is arrested? If it's a minor thing and they'll be back in an hour, might not be reasonable to take the car to the impoundment lot. But if the driver is likely to be away for a while, it's at risk of theft and vandalism. And
I accept that. I'll add that. That's the same thing as saying that it might not be removed immediately or within a short time. But you don't know that because someone else could take the car with the owner's permission. Okay. But they don't have to. The police don't have to ask that.
That's correct. Under Bertin, they don't have to ask. If the driver were to volunteer information, they could close their ears. I think it would be relevant to their decision on the spot in light of the totality of the circumstances.
My colleague accepts the idea that the car can be removed because of the threat of safety. But here's what the Tenth Circuit says about that. And the Tenth Circuit is discussing the Seventh Circuit case, as you well know. You have a division of the circuits here. You have the Seventh, the Eighth, the Ninth, the D.C. Circuit, and the Tenth Circuit saying you need a specialized policy. And you have the 1, 3, and 5 saying not so much, okay.
I quibble with it a little bit, but go ahead.
Okay. This is what the Tenth Circuit is saying about the Duguay case from the Seventh Circuit. The Seventh Circuit concluded that the, quote, suggestion that the police were obliged to impound the vehicle to protect it from theft or vandalism strikes us as making up new police obligations after the fact where none existed before. The police do not owe a duty to the general public to remove vulnerable automobiles from high-crime neighborhoods. And so I think that's a tension from what I heard you say just now and what I heard you say earlier. I'm concerned about the breadth. And if the police, law enforcement, are engaging in community caretaker, and boy, this state has, in my opinion, a very broad community caretaker approach, that once you cross that threshold and say they are, the law enforcement, is exercising community caretaker function, even though it might be a dual function, all you need is the one valid function. If they're exercising that, and if they have, I hear you say, and if they have concern to protect, don't want to leave it there because who knows? Might be theft, might be fire, you know, something might happen to it. So we're going to impound it. You know, that there is some allure to that. Good for you. You're a good Boy Scout and a good Girl Scout. You're helping out. But there's some real fear then, because we're starting with what is a very, very broad community caretaker for law enforcement. And once you pass that threshold and say, now let's go to impoundment, all you need is, well, it's going to be safer if we impound it. That is so broad that it's breathtaking. Can you respond to why I shouldn't be concerned about this, the breadth of what I've just discussed.
I agree that if it were simply a matter of it would be safer to put this in the police garage than to leave it where it is or to move it elsewhere, if that were what the analysis turned entirely on, then it would be a much more expansive doctrine. But it always depends on what the circumstances are. Where is the car parked? Is it parked on private property that belongs to the arrestee? In that case, it's subject to a level of theft and vandalism that exists, you know, that exists when the driver is not under arrest, for example. I mean, and what do they see in the car? In this case, we know that they saw in the front seat a cell phone.
You're getting into the facts, and of course, Fourth Amendment is a fact-intensive inquiry. You know, how many times have I written that? but earlier I heard you not so nuanced in your argument about that if they perceive there might be a threat to the, this is my word, integrity of keeping it safe, that they could take it away. Let me segue to what I really want to talk about, and that is the specialized criteria. The holding of the Tenth Circuit in Sanders, and although the other circuits that required a specialized policy vary or adjust a little bit, but in essence, this is the holding, and I want to start with their holding, and then I want to talk about the policies that we have here for impounding in this record. The holding is, we hold that impoundment of a vehicle located on private property that is neither obstructing traffic nor creating an imminent threat to public safety is constitutional only if, number one, justified by both a standardized policy, and the second thing, and a reasonable, non-pretextual community caretaking rationale. The case law seems to then also require not just that there be a policy, but it be a policy, especially when you're dealing with private property, that cabins the discretion. It can't be, you can impound if you want. We've got a policy, it's written, it's two paragraphs, but in essence it says you can impound if you want. Don't impound if you don't want. You decide. They say that's not good, especially for private property. Do the two policies here pass this cabining of discretion test? Our requirement that standardized criteria guide impoundments on private property ensures that police discretion to impound vehicles is cabined rather than controlled.
They do.
Give me the facts.
Will do. Let me start with the settled law that governs the Fourth Amendment in this court, which is the Supreme Court's decision in Bertin, which is, by Aspeth's contention and by all the court's accounts, the source of this supposed standardized criteria requirement. What did the police policy in Bertin require? Remarkably, it said that police are authorized to impound in a vehicle any time its operator is under arrest. Well, the Dodge County policy is far more demanding. It says the operator of the vehicle has to be under arrest, and not impounding would have to mean that the car would be left unattended. That's a policy that's been approved of in several of the cases that you mentioned, Cartwright, for example, from the Seventh Circuit. And it shows, I think, that the discretion question under Bertin is simply, if there is a policy, are the police following it or are they not following it? Well, that's a question that bears on pretext, I think.
Well, but that it be a policy, the fact that on page 4, paragraph 3, it says policy for impoundment isn't enough.
I agree.
Okay. So, and what more do you need than a written words that say policy for impoundment? Is the indicia of a sufficient policy for impoundment?
Well, to be clear, in our view, you don't need a policy in the first place because Bertin doesn't require it, and I am eager to hear from the other side the answer to this question because I'm not sure what the answer is. I know what Bertin says. I know what the cases that the other side cites say. which is that if you have a policy that says you're arrested and the car would otherwise be left unattended, that's good enough. So it has, I suppose, under that view of the law, which is not the state's view, that would be enough, which is why our argument...
Mm-hmm. No, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Which is why our argument is that this case doesn't present the question that that has caused some trouble in the federal courts of appeals. As Sanders says, no federal court of appeals holds that the absence of a policy automatically renders the impoundment unconstitutional. But to get to the policy
routine,
in this case.
At least according to many of the circuits, their interpretation of routine is this. Our holding, like that of the majority of the circuit, recognizes that routine makes the existence of standardized criteria the touchstone of the inquiry into whether or not the impoundment is lawful. So let's go with that.
I'll certainly agree that there's language in many of these cases that's broader than we'd like, but I think as Sanders rightly interpreted those cases, including Duguay, you can understand, given the facts of the case and given the full analysis of the court, that not everything turns on the policy. But let's go to the policy. Dodge County made the arrest here. They found the car on property that was within their jurisdiction, outside the jurisdiction of the Beaver Dam Police. We know that Detective Johnson of the Beaver Dam Police ultimately concluded and clarified that he was told that the vehicle would be impounded, and he got that message from Lieutenant Luce, who was the ranking officer from the Dodge County Police, who was there. This is a Dodge County seizure. The Dodge County policy says if you are arrested, if the vehicle would otherwise be left unattended, the officers have discretion to seize. That, I think, completely inoculates the Dodge County Police from any claim that their discretion is freewheeling, is unguided, because Bertine's policy was more demanding. I think this highlights why the policy can't be the end-all be-all. What constrains discretion in this context, what best guards against police officers using this doctrine as cover for rummaging for evidence of a crime, are the totality of the circumstances, not some policy that takes up one page, two pages, three pages in an officer handbook. That's the way you constrain discretion. I think the state's test, over the long term, more adequately controls against the risk that is what's motivating this doctrine in the first place. It's what motivates the requirement in the inventory context, which is different, I'll add. And this is important to realize that in Florida versus Wells and the other cases, the reason you need a standardized policy is because there's no other way to constrain officers' discretion in the inventory context. That's because if the car's in your garage, you can inventory it. And your inventory policy can be as broad as necessary to obtain everything within the vehicle and to make a list of what the police are keeping. There's nothing constraining discretion on the front end. The only thing that constrains discretion is if there's a policy that the officers have to come up with before the suspicious vehicle is even in their lot. They have to come up with the rules before the game is played. With an impoundment, the circumstances preceding the decision whether to seize are always changing. It's impossible to predict every scenario in which the officers might need to impound. What constrains their discretion are, in fact, those circumstances. As the First Circuit has put it, virtually by definition, the need to perform community caretaking functions in this context arises fortuitously. It would not be sensible to expect officers to come up with a standardized policy that runs the entire gamut of potential impoundment scenarios. It just can't be done.
I don't think that would necessarily be required, would it, to have a decent policy in place? So, for example, in giving full marks for your comments about it's impossible to foresee all the circumstances in which impoundment might become necessary, a useful policy might say something like, when we make the decision to seize, we will engage the least intrusive method of performing the community caretaker function, right?
Police officers could certainly write such a policy. Then the question would be, what's the least intrusive means? And in a set of circumstances where there is no one...
And that might make a substantial difference in this case, where it appears that the decision to seize can pretty much automatically get you to impoundment, right? Without considering, without trying to accomplish any of the potential options short of impoundment. But a policy could cabin that discretion.
I certainly agree that a policy can help cabin discretion. It can help focus police on cases in which impoundment is most likely to be reasonable. But there are going to be scenarios that fit the impoundment policy where seizure is not the reasonable course of action. Under the Bertin policy, you can imagine that there's somebody sitting in the passenger seat of the car who has a driver's license and who shows that she has titled the vehicle and insurance is in her name. It wouldn't be reasonable, I think we'd all agree, to take the car from that person just because you've arrested the driver. I see that my red light is on.
Well, I have a question for you, namely,
thank you very much.
What about, namely, the Court of Appeals decision is in your favor. Is there anything in the Court of Appeals decision that's in your favor that you think, if I wanted to and I were assigned to write this case, I can't just say I adopt Blanchard's opinion?
Certainly, there are many. I'll name three from the Federal Courts of Appeals.
Good.
COCCIA from the First Circuit,
no.
COCCIA.
I want to know what in the opinion you don't like, you think is
wrong.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I thought you said opinions that we, okay.
No, I want to know in the Blanchard case. I wrote an opinion and said, on behalf of the court, we don't bother to rewrite this case. We just take the Blanchard Court of Appeals decision.
Well, I think Duguay from the Seventh Circuit has language that I think is loose and...
No.
I'm not understanding. I'm sorry.
Yeah, the Court of Appeals opinion here is written by Judge Brian Blanchard.
Oh.
So is there anything wrong with the Court of Appeals opinion in this case is the question.
No. I think it's correct.
Perfectly. No bad sounds.
Not that I recall at the time.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Bradley. Just trying to help.
So first, to respond to Justice Bradley's concerns, first of all, with respect to the sort of justifications that can justify impoundment, I would disagree that theft or vandalism of a vehicle justifies impoundment generally. If you look at Bertin and Opperman, where those phrases originally come from, they're talking not about the impoundment, but about protecting the police from claims of vandalism or theft of the person's items by doing this inventory to say, hey, this is what you had, still there. As you pointed out, Justice Bradley, all cars that are out in public are subject to theft and vandalism.
I read so many cases on this one. There was one case in which the defendant was offered a statement that removed any liability on the cops. Was that this case?
No.
Okay.
No.
That's possible, so you
sure,
can get
certainly.
Rid of liability issues.
And also, I guess, turning to Justice Kelly's concerns regarding alternatives or what exactly, whether all seizures have to be impoundments or whether there are other alternatives, the quotation from Bertin is not that alternatives are never of concern. And once again, I'll point out, they were discussing the inventory when they said this. They said that the existence of reasonable alternatives does not necessarily or invariably determine the reasonability of police actions, not that they never do. And I would agree with, I think, the thrust of Justice Kelly's questioning that it's impossible to make a determination with regard to whether a particular action is a valid community caretaker action without asking, hey, what's the problem and what are the possible solutions? And as far as, you know, the absence of any, the state mentioned that Mr. Asbeth didn't apparently tell the police officers that he had a friend who could move the car or anything like that. Well, you know, for one thing, the burden is on the state. And for another, there was, in fact, a video of Mr. Asbeth's arrest, which was, if you look to the record, you'll see that it was somehow misplaced, no longer exists. We've tried our very best to get it. I can't say whether or not Mr. Asbeth had anything to say with respect to what the police should do with his car, and neither can the state. He was a local. He has lived in Beaver Dam for a long time. And so it's hard to imagine that he didn't know someone who could move the car if he needed it moved. With respect to the discussion of standard policies, I just point out that in Bertine, it is true that the policy said basically you can tow the car anytime you arrest the person. I looked at the briefing in Bertine, and the argument that the defendant in Bertine was making was not that that was overbroad, but that the discretion afforded the officers to do the park and lock option was too broad. So I would say that question really wasn't squarely presented in Bertine. The court mentioned that that was a policy, but it didn't say this is good enough for standardized criteria. And I would also just point out that the Dodge policy, it just says that they can impound a vehicle on arrest of its owner if the vehicle would thereby be left unattended. It doesn't say, if it's out on a public street or even if it's on somebody else's property. Under the policy of the Dodge sheriffs, it would appear that they could tow Mr. Asba's car if they happened to arrest him after he parked it in his driveway. And so I don't believe that policy adequately reflects sort of reasoned judgments about when is it necessary for the police to impound a vehicle. There's no public safety threat there. There's no reasonable threat of theft or vandalism. And with respect to the legal question of whether there's a need for a policy, I would say that, the central question and the reason that those policies exist or should exist is because we want to make sure, once again, that what we're doing here is not an end run around Gantt, not an end run around the Fourth Amendment. We want to know, hey, this is essentially an administrative action that you're talking about. So what are you guys doing here? Are you really effectuating the policies of your department? Or are you simply do you simply have a policy that says, hey, if we feel like towing it, because maybe we think the guy has evidence in it, we can tow it?
Well, it seems to me that one of the themes of good law enforcement management now is that there are in place standards, guidelines, call them what you will, to govern law enforcement officers, always recognizing that individual discretion is needed in particular circumstances. So that's why you have law enforcement guidelines on the use of force, for example, or guidelines on high-speed chases, whether it's on the highway or in town, etc. And that this whole concept of standards and guidelines is what you're encouraging here. It's just in a different area than the two I gave you.
I would agree with that, just to say.
Do you have any other examples or anything else in terms of the concept of good law enforcement that so states it? Usually the police foundation is a good source for that. I did not check their website. Did you?
I don't know the source of those policies either. If that's
thank
the same
you.
Reason, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for a fine argument. You were very responsive to our questions, which sometimes is hard to do when you're standing up there. So we do appreciate it very much. We are now going to adjourn until 3:15, and then the court will meet in closed conference at that time. Thank you very much.